Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI prepares to set off to Austria, his seventh pastoral journey abroad since the beginning of his pontificate. Hundreds and thousands of young and even little girls lose their childhoods, their adolescences, and often their lives as they're forced to join armies and combatants in many of the world's nations. And with Father Jim Brand, we listen in to an intimate dialogue between a guardian angel and a dead man's soul. Benedict XVI is busy getting ready to fly to Austria to join Catholics celebrating the 850th anniversary of the founding of the Mariazell Shrine. Amongst the highlights of his three-day visit, he is scheduled to go to Judenplatz to pray at a memorial to Austrian victims of the Holocaust, celebration of Mass at the Mariazell Shrine, and encounters with church leaders. This pastoral journey is his seventh abroad since Pope Benedict's election in April 2005. And Vatican Radio's Veronika Scherzbrick is in Vienna right now, waiting for his arrival.
On the eve of Benedict XVI's arrival here in Vienna, there's a buzz about town. Austrians are eager to welcome the Pope from neighbouring Bavaria. And the press has been offering practical details about Popemobiles, and with a play of words comparing the Holy See as being mobile by coming here. All in a bid to better prepare for this pilgrimage of the Pope's to Austria, which brings him here to Vienna, but above all on Saturday to a Benedictine place, the Marian Shrine of Mariazell, currently celebrating 8.5 centuries since it was first founded. Perched high in the Styrian Alps, the beauty of this shrine seemed like crystallized under early snowfall this week, crystallized like the Pope's determination to return to this place he loved so well on the occasion of its Jubilee year. As he told us when prompted in an exclusive interview here at Vatican Radio after his election to the papacy, "I really liked that place when I visited in 2004, and I promised, a little imprudently, I'd return to the Magna Mater Austriae," a promise he's kept. And when on Friday he arrives in this nation at the heart of Europe, it won't just be this shrine that's familiar to him. He knows Austria well, has spent many a holiday here. And he often recalls how he went there with his mother crossing the bridge over the Salzach River. He's been back many times since then, sometimes flying the Danube in a steamer. But now, 70 years on, he returns to his old stomping ground, this time round with a difference. There will be no walking across bridges, no plying the Danube in a steamer. Full protocol has moved in. The president, Heinz Fischer, will welcome him here, because for the first time he comes as Roman pontiff. Pontifex in Latin means bridge builder. And he comes then to build bridges, as this title suggests, between all peoples in this overwhelmingly Catholic nation at the crossroads of Europe, where the Danube unites the East with the West, and I would add, where the Church has a reputation for encouraging dialogue with other religions, Christian and non-Christian alike. Between all Catholics of this nation, those who've gone different ways discussing issues, such as the nature of priesthood, the role of laypeople, and the authority of the hierarchy, those in troubled waters, creating deeply seated suffering, situations connected to accusations of paedophilia, which brought the former Archbishop of Vienna to step down in 1995, and then to top that in 2004, further scandal in a seminary involving sexual misconduct. The Roman pontiff then, as I said, comes to build bridges, bring inspiration and comfort. Let's face it, even in a socially well-ordered and economically prosperous country such as Austria, people need to be reconfirmed in their faith. Draw from the motto of this pastoral pilgrimage, look to Christ. And of course, secularization hasn't stopped at the gateway of the great Catholic Austria. But now led by Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, the Archbishop of Vienna, it's not all bad news for the Church here. There is a reawakening in some of the parishes, and there are plenty of success stories, best symbolized perhaps by the vibrant community in the Cistercian Abbey of Heiligenkreuz, which has not had so many new vocations in 200 years. And there are moments of joy, too. The Pope's visit is certainly among these, and promises to have plenty of highlights as the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna and President of the Nations Bishop Conference, Christoph Schönborn, told me with glee.
I am happy that we have so many highlights. The greatest highlight is certainly Mariazell, the Jubilee of Mariazell. And to celebrate the Jubilee with the Holy Father is an enormous privilege and a great joy for many Catholics in Austria and in the surrounding countries. But then there are other highlights. There is reception in the heart of the city of Vienna on Friday lunchtime. Then there will be a short visit and silent remembering of the victims of Shoah nearby the center of the city. And then there will be another highlight on the more political, diplomatic level, the meeting with the diplomats and the representatives of the nations. And at the end of his visit, he will celebrate Mass in St. Stephen's Cathedral, so to say a normal Sunday Mass, which will certainly be not so normal because it is the Holy Father himself who celebrates, insisting on the importance of the Sunday as a day of rest and a day of prayer and worship. And finally, he will spend a short but important visit to one of the big monasteries of Austria near Vienna in Heiligenkreuz. And at the end of this dense program, poor Holy Father, he is 80 years old, and I hope we do not overburden him with such a dense program. He will meet 1,700 representatives of volunteers from civil society and from the church and give an address to them to encourage volunteer commitment for the good of the society.
Whatever the schedule, what's certain is that when Pope Benedict arrives here in Austria, he will certainly prove his skills at bridge building, recalling perhaps the words of the late John Paul II, who during his third and final pastoral visit to this nation in 1998, said Austria must serve as a bridge in the heart of Europe. And when he blows on the embers of a deeply rooted faith, his message will be crystal clear, reaching beyond the nation's borders. In a special way, this will be visible at the shrine at Mariazell on Saturday, where he will celebrate Mass in a place where pilgrims have been coming for so many centuries, seeking refuge and reconciliation, even when it meant crossing an iron curtain. Our Lady here is, after all, significantly referred to with a triple title, Magna Mater Austria of the Austrians, Mater Gentium Slavorum of the Slav people, Magna Hungarorum Domina of the Hungarians. And the tiny ancient statue carved in lindenwood depicting her is symbolic of the theme of Pope Benedict's pilgrimage, as with a gesture she holds out her hand, so large it's out of proportion with the rest of the figure, and with her even larger index finger points to the Christ child on her lap, as if to say, "Look to Christ." Awaiting Pope Benedict in Austria, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
And now, turning to something quite different, my thoughts fly to hundreds of thousands of girls across the globe who are forced to join armies and combatants, victims of man's ruthless pursuit of power. The issue of gender equality and women's rights has always been of concern to me, and often I have chosen to shine the light on realities and problems that millions of women and girls find themselves embroiled in simply because of their sex. Domestic abuse was an especially difficult and painful issue to talk about, because too often it's just too close to home. Equally painful, although much more remote, is the issue of child soldiers, and more specifically, of girl child soldiers, of which, I discovered, there are hundreds and thousands in the world today. Yes, although the use of children as soldiers has been universally condemned as abhorrent and unacceptable, over the last 10 years, hundreds of thousands of children have fought and died in conflicts around the world, one-third of them girls.
There's really, really difficult to document the number of child soldiers for obvious reasons.
Victoria Forbes-Adam works with the coalition to stop the use of child soldiers.
Namely that, you know, if you're in the throes of a difficult civil conflict, there may be many different armed groups recruiting and using children, and armed forces illegally using children, and none of those commanders necessarily want to reveal to human rights organisations or indeed to the UN how many children are in their ranks. So that is really, really difficult. And the best sort of estimates that we have are when the UN goes in the context of a peacekeeping operation and sets up a demobilization program, because then they can register the children that come through the process. So when we published our last global report, which was at the end of 2004, we estimated that there could have been at that time up to 100,000 children involved in armed forces and groups in Africa. But it was really virtually impossible to estimate beyond Africa. In Asia, for example, we know there are child soldiers in Sri Lanka, and in fact, recruitment is on the increase. We know there are children involved in the conflict in Nepal. We know that there may be up to 11,000 children involved in the armed conflict in Colombia, in Latin America. But there are other countries like, for example, the Philippines, where we just have no idea, even though we know that there are two or three groups who are recruiting children. So putting an estimate is extremely difficult. The UN has recently said 250,000, but you know, I think this is really has to be understood as an estimated figure.
Of those figures, however, Victoria confirmed that one-third of all child soldiers are in fact girls. And whilst being involved in armed conflict is a horrific and damaging predicament for any child, girls are subjected to particular abuse and suffering. Victoria, why recruit girls? What are they used for?
There are two things, or even three, actually. One is for the same reasons that boys are recruited. You know, they're pliable, they're easy to manipulate, they're cheap, they can be bossed around, told what to do, they can be easily disciplined. They are useful for providing, as is often the case with children, boys and girls, they can provide logistical support, so maybe carrying and fetching, to carrying out sort of cooking and other chores of that ilk. But the additional issue with girls, as I'm sure many of your listeners can imagine, is that very often they're sexually exploited. So they're taken as wives, in inverted commas. They're taken to be sexual slaves of male commanders. So girls have this kind of additional enormous violation of their human rights, if you like, and their rights as children. And obviously the consequences of that are very grave, because they may suffer very serious physical disability as a result. Many of them, for example, become HIV positive. So the situation and the plight of girls is very difficult.
How young can they be when they're recruited?
Well, it really varies a lot. The majority of the world's child soldiers are adolescents. So, you know, they're between the ages of kind of 12 and 17. And, you know, many of those young people actually volunteer again. One needs to qualify that. Volunteer because they have no choice, because they're living a life of poverty. They don't have access to education or employment, or because they're conscious of you know, human rights violations being inflicted on their families and communities. So there are lots of reasons why children choose, in quotes, to join up. However, in some intensely violent conflict, younger children have been recruited down to the age of 7 even. But I think I would like to emphasize that this is, not the case for every conflict.
And those who don't choose, in inverted commas, Victoria said, are often forcibly abducted from their homes, many of whom never to return. Now, when girls in particular are freed, or the war is over, or an organisation goes in and takes them away from being a soldier, what kind of fate do they encounter? I know that often for cultural reasons it's not easy for them to be reintegrated into their communities.
Yes, I mean, that's a huge issue, and that's particularly an issue for girls, because paradoxically and awfully, in a way, girls who have been subjected to sexual slavery or who have been raped are often then sort of face a double rejection by their communities and families when they return home. And there's a huge stigma attached to that, and their communities reject them. So that is a huge difficulty, and that's something that, you know, many of the member organisations of the coalition, like Save the Children, are struggling to address. And we've come to understand working in this field, that there needs to be significant work with communities to get them on board, to mobilize them, to get them to reflect upon what it means to be a girl soldier in order that they can begin a process of reconciliation and healing.
Victoria, does a child that undergoes such an ordeal ever come through?
That's an interesting and complex question, and obviously there's a lot of discussion and inquiry around that issue. It seems to be the case that young people who've kind of, as it were, volunteered or had some kind of motivation for joining up, and if they're not subjected to extreme forms of violence, if they can be got out of the conflict, if they can be returned to conditions of relative normality and security, and again, I stress security, and if they can be provided with support and assistance, perhaps to return to education, to reintegrate with their communities and so on, it seems to be the case that many of those children can actually be okay and develop and grow up to lead a productive and reasonably okay life. However, obviously, as in any, you know, segment of the population, there will be children who really suffer trauma and distress, and some children are subjected to very extreme forms of violence, either having them being subjected to violence themselves, like beatings or torture, or being forced to commit acts of violence against other civilians, so, for example, to torture or kill somebody. Now, that is obviously very, very serious, and for some of those children, recovery may never be complete.
And reading the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers website, I came across some of the stories Victoria's referring to, like that of the 15-year-old Ugandan girl who saw a boy being hacked to death for not raising the alarm when a friend ran away, and was herself forced to kill a friend who tried to escape. She was then beaten when she dropped a water container, ran for cover under gunfire, and received 35 days of military training before being sent to fight the government army. My next question sounded hollow. You were just mentioning briefly before, there are programs on the ground to help reintegration. How do these programs work, and are they bearing fruit?
There's a huge array of different kinds of programs. I mean, some programs are kind of embedded within broader development aid programs. So, you know, there may be training, vocational training, let's say, which may be for a number of different groups of children within a community, and former child soldiers may get involved in that. So that may be one way of them reintegrating. Other ways are perhaps through more psychosocial programs, which might be aimed towards getting the children to kind of perhaps reflect a little bit on their experiences, perhaps engage in a process of reflection with their communities and try and face up to it and kind of resolve it and perhaps be cleansed, is sometimes the term that's used, so that forgiveness, mutual forgiveness can occur and the community can kind of go back to functioning in a post-conflict situation. As to whether they're bearing fruit, yes, I think they do bear fruit when they're adequately funded and well designed, and that is not always the case. I mean, at the end of a conflict, very often there is a kind of donor fatigue, and perhaps funders and UN agencies withdraw from the scene, and some of these children are left without the sufficient long-term support that really they need in order to kind of complete their recovery and re-engage with society, if you like. So I think sustained funding and careful thinking is required in the long term if these are really going to work out. Now, that being said, it is also the case that in many of these countries, like, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there are huge challenges afflicting the nation, you know, very severe poverty, lack of infrastructure, problems with governance, problems of law enforcement. So at times, the problems that face former child soldiers are the same as those which face the broader population, and they won't be overcome in a short period of time.
So much pain. It's children we're talking about. Children with no childhoods and probably no future. On a very personal level, I asked Victoria how she got involved. She told me she's been working in human rights for about 20 years now, so it's always been part of her daily existence to be confronted with violence and to deal with it in one way or another.
From a personal level, I got interested in the situation of children when I was working in Haiti in the UN human rights mission there. And it became clear that, you know, the rights of children weren't well protected. And we were finding children in the prisons, perhaps not even being charged with a recognizable criminal offense, being left there, not being taken to court. There were no facilities for them. There was no recourse. There was nothing protect these children. There weren't any social services either. So I kind of had begun to document that, and obviously I was working in and out of the prison trying to get children released and so on. And then I came back to the UK actually because I had a child of my own and this job presented itself.
Victoria's commitment to protect children from violence, exploitation and abuse can make the difference between life and death for hundreds, maybe thousands, of little ones out there caught in the throes of adult madness. But for so many, whom we never even hear of, yet another conflict in a faraway land can mean another lost childhood, another tragic predicament for another little girl or another little boy brandishing a gun or having to submit to the whims and fancies of men without morals. And now, turning to something completely different, our friend the musician, Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Beda College here in Rome, accompanies us into the final part of Cardinal Newman's poem, The Dream of Gerontius, when the guardian angel lowers Gerontius into the soothing lake of purgatory with the final blessing and promise of a reawakening to glory.
In my last thought piece about the dream of Gerontius, that was the second talk, we left Gerontius, having been exposed to God's love, crying out, take me away, I can't handle this. And what happens now is that the guardian angel takes him and lends him overnight to the souls in purgatory. Now, I think there are two prides that stop us getting to heaven. One is, if I think I'm better than anyone else, when I reach heaven, I look in. Oh, they're all there, all my prejudices, I'd rather go elsewhere. And all hell is your wishes come true, because hell is monochrome, monotony, infinite monotony. Tables set for one. You only go to hell if you choose to. This place laid for us in heaven, where the whole world is going to be. I remember seeing a cartoon in Punch. I think it was 1912, some frightfully rich lady in her horse and carriage stopping at the end of her estate. We could see the drive and her palace at the far end. The gypsy woman's begging, and this rich lady's leaning out, or is holding her nose, and giving this poor woman a penny. And the poor woman says, thank you, madam, may we meet in heaven. Her ladyship says, I should hope not. Anyhow, you'll find everyone in heaven, so we might as well get used to poly everything on earth. If hell is monochrome, heaven is poly everything. All the colours, all the tribes, all the classes, all the cultures, all the languages. So thank goodness we're in a multicultural world, so that when we reach heaven, we shall feel at home, rather than a strange place. The second thing that stops us getting to heaven, I think, is if we're too proud to receive. I always pay for my seats. I'll get into heaven by paying with my good works and my prayers and all that. Well, you can't buy God's love. You don't pay for love with God. We can only go to heaven if we realize we're poor, unprofitable servants and can only receive something. So I think those are the two prides that stop us getting to heaven. But all of us have lazy muscles. It's much easier sometimes to love than to be loved, because we hate being changed. And I think what purgatory is, for Newman, is an intensely sharp growing pain. I remember when I was chaplain in the Middlesex Hospital, we had the curtains round one bed I was going to with offering communion. And there was a curtain round the next bed and I could hear... I think, oh gosh, somebody's getting some treatment. And then the curtain would fly back. A tiny little 5-foot physiotherapist would come out, as cool as a cucumber, leaving behind a patient absolutely worn out, because there's nothing more painful than pins and needles. So the guardian angel lends this loved Gerontius, just overnight, to the souls in purgatory. And this is what he sings. Softly and gently, dearly ransomed soul, in my most loving arms I enfold thee. And o'er the penal waters as they roll, I poise thee, I lower thee, and hold thee. Carefully I dip thee in the lake, and thou without a sob or resistance, dust through the flood, thy rapid passage take, sinking deep, deeper into the dim distance. Now he sings about physiotherapist angels. Angels to whom the willing task is given shall tend and nurse and lull thee as thou liest. And masses on earth and prayers in heaven shall aid thee at the throne of the most highest. Just before he went before the judgment, you could still hear people praying round the bed on earth. And here we have this wonderful idea of the communion of saints, the church on earth, the church in purgatory, and the church in heaven, all in communion with each other, all praying together. And then the angel sings, farewell, but not forever, brother dear. Be brave and patient on thy bed of sorrow. Swiftly shall pass thy night of trial here, and I will come and wake thee on the morrow. And you can hear the angels in heaven singing just through the curtain. So purgatory has nothing to do with hell at all. It's the antecamera, or washroom, or bathroom, should we say, powder room, the wash and brush up, the gymnasium, before we can go to heaven and handle the richness of God's love without it destroying us. And in the final Amen, you'll hear the souls in purgatory that have just welcomed Gerontius into their community overnight. You can hear the angels in heaven, the people on earth, all singing four great Amen, 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 Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.